Here's a question. Where does this lack of hang-up come from? Ellis, where's this humility from?
My mum did teacher training in the 70s, and I was never allowed guns as a kid because mum thought violent toys breed violent play, which breed violent children, which breeds violent adults. Mm-hmm. So I grew up on quite a normal street, and it was all starter homes, so the adults were all my parents' age and lots of kids my age, and all the boys would play war, but I didn't have guns to defend myself, so I'd be dead within 10 seconds and then I had to die theatrically to remain in the game. I think they did a very good job, and there's no favouritism. I've never thought that, you know, I'm one of three, and it was just quite balanced. It was quite happy and all that sort of stuff, and I just loved comedy. I just love a laugh, and I don't understand people who don't like laughing. I've had people tell me at gigs, I don't really want to come here tonight because I don't like comedy. I think, what? Very few people say that they don't like music.
Yeah.
It's just...
The music comedy analogy seems never to occur to civilians. The idea of being... That's the
I went to a music gig once and I didn't like it, so I haven't been back.
Yeah. Or I went to a music gig not knowing what the four artists were going to play.
Yeah. And it turns out
I'm into Slayer and they didn't play any Slayer. So
Yeah, it was all country. And I like, you know, Kraftwerk.
Yeah.
So unfortunately I had to leave. And my dad's a bit of a character, and I just loved stories as a kid. I was read to a lot. And I think the most exciting thing is when I used to live with people and we all worked in different offices, if someone like messed up, if a friend of mine came back and said, "You'll never guess what my boss did today." I just love being in a pub and someone telling me stories of their, you know, from their lives. I just think that's the most fun thing.
What is the significance to you of the not being allowed guns element of that? That you were brought up non-competitively? Is that
the other thing is, I would say, I wonder if this is changing actually, but when I was growing up in Wales, it was very important not to be seen to be a show-off or to boast or to think too much of yourself. And I was talking to Mike Bubbins, a comedian, about this, and he said that when he was a kid playing rugby, if he scored a try, the coach and his dad and all the other dads would say, "You can't celebrate because you look big-headed."
Oh my God.
So I think my mum thought...
That's why I'm no good at sport.
But my mum thought a lot about sort of raising happy children. She'd done child psychology at university and stuff. And so I just think that it was... Like, we weren't smacked and things. And I think it was slightly different to my peers, but because my mum had studied this stuff. And I think my two sisters are very ultra-balanced.
Okay.
So they don't have any problems. None of us really do.
Your mum's got to write a book on this.
Have you met my mum? You must have met my mum. She goes to a lot of gigs now. She discovered stand-up when she came to Edinburgh to watch me do my show in 2009. And then she went to see people I recommended, who were just people like Josh Whitaker, my friends of mine. And she loved it. And now she goes for a week and she watches 7 or 8 shows a day.
I love it when mums are connected. But parents.
So, yeah.
Nish's parents.
Joel Isett's mum and Joel Dommett's mum.
I was going to mention Joel Dommett's mum. I won't name her. But yeah, Acaster's parents.
Yeah.
They're just super involved and they go and see everything.
Oh, my mum. And also my mum loves very alternative stuff. So she doesn't like Live at the Apollo. She likes Bridget, Josie Long, Nadia Kamal, she loves. Who else does she like? Birthday Girl, she's a huge. And John Kearns, she's a massive John Kearns fan.
My mum is a massive John Kearns fan.
And a big Acaster fan.
What an incredible sentence to be able to say.
So my dad will say, my dad will watch John Bishop and say, "Oh, he's the funniest man on telly," or Kevin Bridges. Whereas mum's tastes are far more alternative and esoteric.
That's interesting. So you have approached comedy. Like, you've approached life with a sense of balance and calm kind of reflection on it. Like, that seems very opposite to the sort of the roller coaster ride of emotion that I would say most comedians. I'm not saying we're all depressed.
Yeah, I enjoyed school and I enjoyed university and I absolutely loathed work. I detested every second of it. And I got ill with stress, actually, because I just couldn't cope with office life.
What kind of office work were you doing?
I was just doing temping, mainly temping and data entry, and that I did data entry for a pipe company.
With no
and
particular
sort of
plan as to your career,
which was
path
the frightening
before
thing.
You discovered a route to sitcom.
Because I thought that all comedians were born in London or they just landed there from the sky, because I'd never met anyone who was involved in telly, and I'd never met and certainly never met anyone who was involved in comedy. So I didn't know how you got on BBC Two on a Friday night. It just seemed this huge jump. And they'd all seemingly had gone to Oxbridge as well.
Yep.
But after a couple of years of temping and earning minimum wage and thinking, oh, I'm not going anywhere. And I was bad. I would get sacked all the time. So then it's frightening then, because I wasn't cut out for a PhD, so I couldn't go back to university. So I needed to do something. And it was really,
really
scary.
I can't possibly stay at university any longer.
But I thought I have to do something. And also I couldn't afford to do another MA, and that would have been insanity. And, you know.
So when you say you got ill with stress, what were the kind of symptoms you were experiencing?
Oh, just awful stomach cramps and all sorts of things. God, and yeah. And I would, an eczema. I used to get eczema, but I just wasn't cut out for it.
I really remember that period very, whatever the opposite of fondly is.
Oh, God. I think I am balanced, but I don't want to come across as a cunt.
Tell me about that. That mic will have picked that up. What do you mean? You think you are balanced, but you don't want to come across as a cunt.
I think I am balanced, but that's not a very nice thing to say, because lots of people aren't, aren't they? And lots of people who have.
So even in a description
issues
of your own balance, you don't want to be showing off about how balanced you are.
Yeah, okay. Because
now that's balanced.
What an awful person to say, oh yeah, you know, I haven't got any hang-ups. But you know,
but that's not awful. That's a true reflection
of
yourself.
No, but so many people have. And if I was listening to this podcast at home and I had issues, I would think to myself, oh, that's great. Oh, well, his life is brilliant. And so I don't want to come across as an arrogant,
now that to me,
balanced person.
That to me seems almost, I'm like, I think Ellis might have a flaw. No. Like the idea, not to suggest that you're flawless, but for someone who is, you know, happy, and that's great.
Yeah.
You know, I'm listening to you talk about your childhood, and obviously, as a father, whenever anyone mentions childhood now, part of me goes, how can I give... That's why I said your mum should write a book. I want to use that. I want my baby to be as happy as you, right? For someone who's, broadly speaking, happy, calm, enjoys their job, enjoys their life. I think, so far, the closest to a kind of a flaw is just that, just what we're tickling towards there, is that notion that you think it might be offensive to people for you to be talking about how balanced,
well,
you are. That to me seems like it's a little bit neurotic.
It's the same reason that rich people shouldn't talk about how great it is having lots of money, because the vast majority of people don't have lots of money. The median income in this country is £23,000 per annum. So when, I don't know, if Justin Bieber talks about how brilliant it is lighting cigars with £50 notes, a lot of people justifiably, I think, could think, cheers, mate.
Well, that's beautifully put, but do you really think that's the same with happiness?
I don't know. I think if I was struggling with... So I know lots of people...
I mean,
people,
it's not like you're showing off about how happy you are.
No.
And that, I think, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
You fear that you're showing off about it when you're not,
yeah,
by any means.
I just... lots of... I didn't go into comedy from a place of pain, is what I would say.
Understood.
I went into comedy because I'm fascinated by it, and I love watching people laugh, and I love watching funny people. And until quite recently, if I wasn't closing, I would always stay to watch the closer, because comedy's great.
Yeah.
It's really good. And
that is a healthy comedian.
The one thing I did have, which lots of people don't, is for a long time, if I broke even on a gig, I would do it regardless of the drive. So I would go to... But, you know, this isn't... All professional comics have done this.
Okay.
You know, I would drive to Leeds for 20 quid on a Monday night and then go to work the next day having had 3 hours sleep.
Sure.
And I never resented the drive, and I never resented the social occasions I missed or the friendships that put a strain under, because as soon as I realised... It took me 3.5 years to go full-time, and I wouldn't say I was obsessed by it, but it was absolutely my goal, and it was the first time I'd had a goal, because I went to university because everyone did, and I did an MA because I was scared of the real world, and I liked my degree, so I thought, well, I'll do that again, a bit more of that. And then I worked in offices because what else was I going to do? I wasn't going to move back with my parents. I wasn't going to work in a pub again or a shop. I thought at least that's progress, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do or how I was going to get to this place. I remember standing in a post office buying road tax when I was about 23, thinking, this can't be it. Surely not.
So
I used to get awful imposter syndrome as an adult. I used to think, surely I'm 13. I can't be insuring my own car and I can't be allowed to drive.
Oh, I see. I see what you mean.
Surely not. And then as soon as I was a comic, apart from the very first two tax returns, which were an absolute shambles, I thought, okay, well, I'm a self-employed person. And I realised it was the only thing I was able to do. And now if comedy goes wrong, I've got no options because I could go back to that.
Do you feel like there's any danger that comedy could go wrong? That's a thing we don't often talk about on this, but like some sense of, I might ask someone, what would you do if it all went
right,
pop?
Yeah, yes, because I read a lot of biographies of musicians and of comedians. I read a lot of biographies of footballers usually, and sports people, boxers as well. And everyone, seemingly, no matter what field you're in, you have probably a 10-year sweet spot in the main when you're really something. So I adore Frank Skinner. I think he's probably the greatest stand-up comic England's ever produced. And yet his 10-year sweet spot was probably, I would say, 92 to 2002. Uh-huh. And he's still brilliant. He's great on the radio. He's still writing good stuff. I did his gig a couple of years ago and he was a great compi like he always was, but he really spoke to people for about 10 years. And I think Steve Coogan is one example of someone who's coming up with even better stuff now than he was 15 or 20 years ago, but it's rare. And I listened to my first Edinburgh show. I found an old recording of it when I moved house and I listened to about half an hour of it. And there were references in 2009 that aren't funny anymore, but were funny then. And they weren't even jokes. It was just the reference was enough to get a laugh. And it really made me think, because I was 28. And there is something about being 28 in particular where you're young enough to be relevant to proper young people, but also you're the child of the slightly older people in the audience. So you can sort of span everyone at 28. And now I'm aware that my childhood in the 80s is so irrelevant to modern teenagers. And even my experiences as a teenager, I didn't have a phone till I was 18. I didn't have an email address till I was 19. My daughter, I will be like a prehistoric dinosaur to her. And so I think I couldn't...
Not like one of these modern dinosaurs.
But I don't think I could... Those. And also, I think the longer you're a comic, the less like a normal person's life.
Well, you've alluded to that a couple of times. You said
that really worries me. See, that makes me think, I've come to your house because I'm recording a thing in Cardiff and they've put me up in a nice hotel. And for a long time when I did gigs, I used to stay in B&Bs or I would drive back or the hotels would be awful. But the more successful you become, the nicer your life is.
Yes.
And the less like most people's lives that is. The one great lever, I think, is having children, because unless you have a nanny, and who does?
Sure.
You know, you're still cleaning shit up.
Yes.
And that...
I'm finding the last show I wrote, it was by no means easy to write, but I think it's my best show, and I think that's because I've got more to complain about as a father. I think I used to have a really easy life where I would sometimes feel like I had to manufacture problems in order to have material, but holy shit, now I've got some problems.
And if you're, I don't know, if you're a multimillionaire and you can get someone else to take your baby to have their jabs or whatever, then you don't see any of that side of stuff. But, you know, I still do all of that.
Yeah.
But in the main... you know, once you, like, if you do any telly, you're really pampered when you're doing telly. And if you do too much telly, you can get used to it and think that that is how your life should be all of the time.
Yes.
Whereas when I was 28, I'd only been a full-time comic for about 9 months. So I could still talk about work. Whereas when I had an office job, I didn't even have an email address. I wasn't allowed access to the internet when I had an office job. So suddenly that's like an anecdote from 50 years ago. We were using fax when I was working in an office. And it's just...
Okay.
It makes you feel old and it makes you feel less relevant because a comedian's life is not like most people's lives. I think a very interesting way of dealing with that is... Skinner did it to an extent. When John Bishop goes to the BAFTAs or the Comedy Awards or corporates, he takes his old mates... his old scouse mates, and then he gets their angle on things.
Yes, that is smart.
So when I did my Welsh language tour to write the Welsh language show, my best friend from school came to a lot of those gigs because he's just been blessed with this wonderful turn of phrase. So speaking with him in Welsh, it got the cogs whirring.
Yes, okay.
But because he was unemployed at the time, but now he's, he used to work for university and now he's doing something else. he has a very... The fact that when I got backstage, they'd have often put out sandwiches and Diet Cokes.
You don't even notice it.
You're completely
blind to it. Whereas he'll walk backstage and go, there's sandwiches there. Yeah. And you can 100% think of Bishop walking on stage and going, yeah, got these sandwiches. Yeah,
and
he would
say, and we did one gig, and the only food there was minstrels. But he was like, they've got minstrels. Whereas I was thinking, great, I'm going to have to do the show without having had a proper tea. But it was very refreshing hanging out, seeing stand-up from the perspective of someone who's never performed. And I think that's quite useful. And the other thing is, when I was talking about going to the Glee for the first time, most people at the Glee Club haven't been to comedy before. Yes. So when you do crowd work of the kind that we do as compares, it is generally knocking people's socks off. Yeah. But you forget. Because you've done thousands of gigs.
I absolutely remember when I started doing professional gigs. I remember thinking, how is this comedy circuit alive, given the number of people who, after a gig, say to me, I've never been to comedy before?
Yeah.
You're like, what every club should be marketing solely to people who've never been here before, yeah, because that's an enormous portion of the audience.
Yeah. And it just amazed me. And I remember that night when after I'd done the first show, I remember thinking, well, there's the Comedy Store, because I'd seen a documentary about it. And there's the gig in Edinburgh where the Edinburgh Festival happens. Because I'd never been. And if you haven't been, the news does stuff from the Edinburgh Festival every year. And it's always street performers and students flying.
Yeah.
So as someone...
That's what the Edinburgh Festival looks like. You can't take a picture of the Edinburgh Festival, and if you try to, it's a bloke up a ladder.
So as a teenager...
Juggling.
As a teenager with a very, very low cringe threshold,
yeah,
I used to watch the news at 6, and it'd be, the 1997 Edinburgh Festival is underway, and it would be a bloke up a ladder and a street performer, and I'd think, fuck that. What is that?
Why would you go?
What is that?
Yes.
And no one ever took me, so I didn't realise there was stand-up on and serious theatre and all that sort of thing. I just had no idea. You know, of my friends from school, probably 4 or 5 of them have been up to watch me, and then they always go to the free stuff, whereas I would always send them to the Pleasants, because that's where most of my friends were on. Uh-huh. And they'd say, but that's £10. And you think, of course.
Yeah, why would you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm getting in on a pass. So they're going to want to see
that element.
They're going to want to see, and you. It's amazing how naive you can be about what most people, how important most people think comedy is, which is not very important at all.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's like I'm fond of saying, there's, you know, the mark of whether someone's famous, I think, is whether my sister has heard their name.
Yes,
and
yes,
there are
yes.
almost no famous comedians.
Yeah, my sister's the same. Yeah, yeah.
Because I remember you saying you were a funny kid, you're making people laugh at work and at uni. Do you remember the ways in which you were most commonly funny?
I think I was less vain than I am now, and I was willing to do anything if I thought it was going to be funny, really. Because okay. I was a bit bored, I think. Having a laugh was a way of livening things up, but and a lot of my friends were the same. We used to dare each other and all that sort of stuff. However, for instance, I remember once being put in a trolley and pushed on a hill, and everyone laughing, and people were laughing for the wrong reasons, but I didn't care because it was laughter all the same.
Okay.
But then I would go home and try and work out why that was funny, because I think that meant more to me than friends of mine. I was quite interested in the mechanics of it, if you know what I mean.
You were, even at the time, after being pushed down the hill as a student.
I think so, yeah.
They were laughing and you'd go home and have a think.
Yeah,
about
looking back, if there were 50 kids watching me being pushed down a hill in a trolley, 35 of them would have been laughing and hoping I was going to break my leg.
And you'd
10 would have been
brainstorming.
Yeah,
in your room
10
going,
would have been showing genuine concern.
Yeah.
And 4 or 5 would have been thinking, oh, we feel quite bad about this.
Okay.
But yeah, I think, I used to do a lot of voices and impressions. That was it. I used to I could do impressions of teachers and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So it was never like jokes, it was act outs.
And in your stand up practice now, what other things do you recognise as being typical of yourself? Like that voice, that kind of angry, powerless little voice.
It's
what other things, what other pedals do you find yourself
It's
pressing?
That Frank Skinner thing of certain things being turned up to 10 and certain things being turned down to 2. But I think that when I was a bit younger, I was putting myself into more dangerous situations through genuine ineptitude. That's probably funnier than having a mortgage. I need to now, I think, for the next show, work out what's funny about me now. because you don't want to get stuck in. I don't want to dust off the t-shirt I used to wear for 2009 Edinburgh Festival and have to grow my hair again.
But presumably to someone with your writing and storytelling abilities, is there jeopardy to find in trying to pay the mortgage on time? Or so do you mean, is there, because there are adult functional stand-ups.
The direct debit has absolutely ruined my stand-up career. It's an interesting time to be a comic. I think having children is quite eye-opening because as a comic, it's like being a student with disposable income, but it's a very, very alien lifestyle to most people. But when my daughter goes to school, I'm still going to have to get her there on time. And suddenly, we've met a far more normal people as well because we did, you know, antenatal classes and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So, and they are all fascinated by stand-up in the way that I was. Do you make it up? You know, is it different every night? Do you just make it up on the spot? And you think you're quite high up in an insurance firm. What's that? Make it up every night? And it's quite. For instance, I love football, but I did Richard Herring's podcast, and he asked me about it because it was just after the European Championships, and I'd been out to watch Wales play, and I could kid myself that everyone has my obsessions with football, but they really don't. And when I started talking about it, I could see people's eyes glazing over. And that being relevant thing, that is probably my chief concern. Because also, when I was growing up, there were only 3 or 4 channels, or whatever it was. And so everyone watched the same things. Whereas now, like, I'm quite interested in, at the moment, Hitler's rise to power. So I'm currently watching Nazis: A Warning from History online because it's just there, because everything is there. It was on the BBC in 1997. But most people I know aren't doing that. But the internet allows you to have your own very niche.
Other Nazi enthusiasts. Yeah.
Finally. But it allows you to entertain your own niche interests. And I think with stand-up, you have to be relevant to a broad... Like, I don't watch many of the box sets people watch. I haven't seen Game of Thrones. So I don't understand a lot of the references that currently are de rigueur. And it's quite disorientating because there was a time when I was the reference guy.
Yes, okay. That's interesting. And were you saying, or were you about to say there, that as a stand-up you have to have your finger on the pulse of those cultural references?
Yeah, the most exciting development in my stand-up career is that since we've done the Radio X show, John and I, we've been able to tour as the two of us. And he did a tour on his own, and it was largely Radio X fans.
Yeah.
And the exciting thing is that I toured before I did the Radio X show, and as it is for lots of people who've done little bits and bobs, some people are there because they like you, some people are there because they like the flyer, some people are there because you're Welsh. That used to happen in the Welsh gigs all the time. But with the Radio X thing, we didn't have to introduce ourselves at all, straight in, bang, and they are all people who are fans of the show, so they like the things we like. It's how I imagine student gigs would be until I started doing student gigs. I assumed student gigs were going to be amazing.
Yeah, I'm young, they're young, yeah, get on.
We're going to get on. And then you realise it is 11 embarrassed 18-year-olds staring at lager in plastic pint glasses who don't want to be talked to. And you think, oh, right. Like, I thought our podcast would be really big with students, but it isn't. It's big with people our age, I think. But the feeling of going on stage in Bristol or London or wherever and not having to dumb down, basically, because you knew people would get it. And there are certain circuit gigs like this. Like, there's a gig called... it's Bush Hall Presents, the one Tom Sewell runs in Shepherd's Bush. And I compare that quite a lot. They really will go for a niche reference to sort of early 80s American indie, which you can't do at most gigs. And I don't know how he's created that, but that is absolutely out of the question at 99% of shows.
Sure.
But certainly on tour with John, it was amazing what we could get away with and what people knew. Because that audience is there, you just have to find them. And on the normal circuit, you know, you can make that joke and there might be someone at the back who's laughing, but the people on a work stool would have switched off because you're, you know.
And how much pressure would you feel as a comic outside of the tour with John? Because I'm aware that because we're doing this live podcast with you and John, yeah. I don't want to sort of give away too much, which I'm afraid to say will almost certainly have sold out by the time anyone hears this. I hope you managed to get a ticket for it. But I'm talking to the listener there, Ellis, yeah. Not you. So how much credence would you as a circuit comic pay to that idea that there has to be a sort of a denominator? Would you rub off the corners?
Because I was never a particularly critically acclaimed comic, actually, and because I see my job is to be as funny for as many people as possible, because I grew up doing the circuit. I think if I'd grown up in London, I would have done the character and sketch scene, which is a fascinating, fascinating scene and completely different to the stand-up scene. And yes. It is one totally London-centric. It does not exist anywhere else.
That's a good point, yes.
So it's
presumably Manchester has a...
No, I don't think in the same way.
No.
It might well do, but
and that would have been a more efficient tip if you'd heard someone say, oh, you want to get into sitcom,
yeah,
move to be a sketch guy.
Izzy did a lot of those gigs, my partner, and when I started going out with her, she would say, oh, yeah, well, you know, and she knew all the different... She knew different comics. She knew comics like Colin Holt and David Reed and Tom Tuck and people like that, who she had known from the couch and sketch circuit, who I hadn't bumped into because I was doing stand-up. But there was no character and sketch, or if there was, they would let you do it at an open mic stand-up night and it usually wouldn't work. And the thing with the character and sketch circuit is that there's often only about 15 people in the audience. There'll be 10 acts, two of whom would be genius, one of whom would be Tim Key, or it'll be Humphrey Carton, it'll be a piece of genius and the best thing you've seen all year. A few will be fine, and then there'll be some absolute doggerel, in my experience. Whereas if you turn up at the Banana Cabaret, the standard is fairly uniform. If you turn up at the Comedy Store, the standard's fairly uniform. And the thing with the character and sketch circuit, it is more to do with people expressing what they find funny, I think. Whereas when I was a stand-up, very quickly I wanted it to be my job. And I wanted to be booked in places.
Yes, because I think with character and sketch, it's not an option that you're going to... There's not enough of a paid circuit of it.
Absolutely.
It's not going to be your job.
There is
you
no
might
paid
as well
circuit.
Only follow your
so,
heart.
Yeah, so there'll be producers there and casting agents, and people might put you on a TV programme if you're lucky. But certainly that's not going to be your job, which is why the character and sketch circuit, in my experience, is often... It's often young people or younger people because they don't have those concerns yet. And... The thing with stand-up was it was my job because it was people's nights out. Once you're doing the proper clubs, people are paid 18 quid or whatever, you've got to deliver, I think. It's out of the question to not be funny then. And so if you've got to change some stuff, then that's fine, I think, because that's the job. I don't think I never really thought I was an artist. I'm an entertainer. The other thing I was going to say about sketch is that I was in a sketch group called Here Be Dragons, and we did... a couple of series on Radio Wales.
Yes, with Lloyd and
Carriad. Yeah, Lloyd Langford, Carriad Lloyd, Sean Harris, who writes Man Down, Ben Partridge, Gareth Gwynne. There were a lot of Nadia Kamal, lots of people. And we used to record them at Up the Creek, and it was such fun working with those people. I loved that show. But Ben Partridge wrote a sketch, and it was the diary of a magpie. It was from the perspective of a teenage magpie. And in the writer's room, we all laughed and thought it was funny, but we all deep down thought, that's getting chopped because it's too weird. But, you know, we really like the sketch, and you over-record at a sketch, that sketch recording. So it went in. And Nadia did a very funny sort of working-class teenage Swansea voice for it. And it got rounds after round of applause. And we all thought, oh, wow. And then we were doing records straight after the interval. And it was another magpie sketch, like one of Ben's backup magpie sketches. We were like, oh, you got to do that, got to do that. So Carriad said, Diary of a Magpie, and Nadia did it. And again, you know, and then for the second week, a week later, Carriad said, Diary of a Magpie. People started clapping because they just loved that sketch. So then we're like, right, you've got to write as many of these as you can, because clearly... magpie diaries are what is funny now. And I never ever would have guessed that. And we all got taken by surprise, and BBC Wales animated them, and that went, you know, that became really successful. And the Diary of a Magpie was what they used on all the marketing. But if you told me beforehand, try and guess which one of the sketches would be the successful one, that would have been bottom of the list.
Okay.
And as someone who'd been writing for 10 years, it made me think, well, I just don't know anymore, do I? I don't know. That's why I have to preview, because I've completely lost faith in what I think I know about comedy, so I have to try it out in front of an audience. Because you'd think that your confidence would improve the more experience you get. But I've been surprised too many times by people I think are rubbish getting huge laughs and people I think are very talented getting nowhere.
So presumably it's not sufficient for you to think, hang on, this radio show, we're getting big crowds, we're selling out. You sold out. Did you sell out the Shepherd's Bush Empire in record time or something?
It sold very quickly, yeah.
So it's not enough for you to think, great, I've got an audience now that I can... I don't know what the size of the audience is,
I was confident about the tour with John because we did a lot of crowd work, and between the two of us, I'm fairly confident that would be funny because he's one of the best compis in Europe.
Undoubtedly, yeah.
So, and he's so good off the cuff. So I think, well, if there's between the two of us, this should be all right. But certainly on my own... I've got a fair inkling, but I will always be surprised at what works and what doesn't. I think when I first started writing stand-up after that first good gig, I think I thought, well, everything I think of now will be funny because I was the funny guy at school and I was the funny guy at university. And then you have a few bad gigs. And the bad gigs when you're an open spot are horrendous.
Oh, yeah.
And if you've still got...
My magical dream thing that's going to change my life suddenly isn't real.
You know, and if that doesn't give you a bit of humility, then nothing will. So, you know, you need a bit of that humility or you'll go insane, I think.
I know that you've done a lot of acting. I've seen you in Josh. I've seen you in Crims. Are there other kind of highlights for you?
Sort of Radio 4 stuff as well.
Yes.
Okay. Krakenori and other bits and bobs.
Okay.
Short films.
I feel like I should be able to ask better questions of comic actors.
Right.
Because my experience lies 99% within stand-up.
Yeah.
I feel like my angle, such as it is to do with creativity. Now, when someone's been given a script and is nonetheless doing a creative job with that script, I always feel as an interviewer, I don't know how to shuck that particular oyster.
The thing I'd say with that is that I think as a truism of stand-ups who act, stand-ups usually think they can improve the script. And if they don't think a line is good enough, they will change it. And some writers are fine with that. But many, I would say most aren't with good reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with Ricky Champ on Crims, who is a world-class comic actor. So he's been in Him and Her. He's been in lots of things.
Okay.
But he is so funny. He would offer a different interpretation. Not every line, not every take, but certainly enough so that in the edit they could choose. But it was always within the parameters of what the writers wanted. And he never changed words because he didn't feel he had the right to as an actor because he wasn't the writer. It would just be... He did a lot of excellent eyebrow work. And I remember once there was a scene in Crims, which I found really funny because he'd had to tell me off for something. And then he gets a call on the walkie-talkie and then he walks down the corridor and he took the call in a very camp way. So there was this great transformation from him bollocking me, and he's much taller than I am as well, and he's quite physically imposing, to then he takes the call in a very camp way, and then he walks down the corridor in a camp way, and then he turns back and then he's hard. And then he used to tell me that his character would stand with his hands on the table like a cat rather than like a dog.
Okay.
He just thought about absolutely everything. There wasn't a single word in any line that he hadn't thought of trying to make funnier with his acting, whether it was body language. He was really into body language as well. And it was a masterclass, whereas of working with someone who is that thoughtful about it, because plenty of actors aren't, but the best ones are. And I just thought he was incredible, because if a line didn't work, he would never change the line. He would change his performance.
That's really
interesting.
Whereas
as a comic...
Yeah.
I would want to chat to the writer and say, actually, can we say something else?
Because it'll be within what I know is funny.
Yeah,
I said that. I can sell that.
And yeah,
the writer might well not want it sold.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Or they don't want that particular thing sold. They want what they've written sold. So it's
because
your job.
They bothered writing it.
Yeah,
thinking
so it's your
about
job
it.
As an actor to do that. And on Josh, it's far looser than Crims was, because Josh wrote it.
Yes.
And Josh is my friend. And in rehearsals, we improvise a lot. And David Schneider, the director, is big into improvising. So he would often, the first line on the page, he would say, right, talk in character up to that point, and then we'll film it. And if it's funny, it'll go in. And if not, we'll just start it. But I want you to be talking before you get to that first line because I want the dialogue to sound very natural. And he was all for letting us mess about. And they're both equally valid, but watching Ricky work, it was just incredible what he can do with his eyebrows and his body language to eke laughs out of something without changing the words. Whereas as a writer, it was always the first thing I wanted to look at. But that's not my job. That's my job is to say the words. And, you know, that's probably that is to my detriment. That is definitely to my detriment. But with Josh, because he wrote it with Tom Crane's also a friend, and it's a looser thing.
Yes. Okay. So given that you've got a few years of comedy acting under your belt now, yeah. TV comedy acting, if you now could time travel back to Ellis day one of first TV comedy job, what would you tell yourself in a short space of time? How would you get yourself up and running?
I think because I was friends with the writers on Crims, which is the first big thing I did, I think, how can I put this? By the time you get to filming, time is very, very tight. You start at 8 and you finish at 7 and you've got to do 10 pages a day. And I think I should have been having more of the discussions in the rehearsals because it's time, and if everyone is having wants to have the discussions you're having, then the thing will just grind to a halt.
Yeah.
And I think people are too accommodating because the time constraints are amazing.
Yes,
you've just got to do stuff so quickly. I know it's probably different in America, but certainly in the UK, you've got 6 weeks to write to film 6 episodes, and if it's not done, there's no more money. There's no time. There's no more money. By the time you're filming in a studio, it's too late to come with lots of suggestions of changing the lines.
Okay.
Because that's just wasting everyone's time.